Hi, this is Bobby Rydell, and you're watching Mr. Media.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll welcome a singer whose signature sound and style has endured across an astounding 7 decades, Bobby Rydell. He's just released a memoir, Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances. Stick around. This guy's even got a high school named after him. It never registered with me. Rydell High, that is. The name of the school where, you know, Danny Zuko and Sandy reunite, where the T-Birds and the Pink Ladies rule the roost. As many times as I have watched that movie over the years, it never clicked that calling the fictional institution Rydell High School was a tribute to America's most famous Rydell, Bobby. That's pretty cool. Even if it was his friend Frankie Avalon who played the film's teen angel, not him. After all, South Philly's gift to teen pop and later adult cool, Bobby Rydell, has enjoyed more than his share of fame and fortune. There were the hits, none bigger than Volare, and of course co-starring in the film version of Bye Bye Birdie with Dick Van Dyke and Anne Margaret. And now it's all come together in his new autobiography, Teen Idol on the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances, a mostly happy life story, until it's not. Bobby Rydell is kind of a stealth American cultural icon. And 30 years ago, I reviewed his Golden Boys of Bandstand tour appearance with Fabian and Frankie Avalon at the old Bayfront Center Theater here in St. Petersburg, Florida. And maybe he won't like this, but I remember going in and thinking Fabian and Frankie were likely the real stars. But then along came Too Cool for School Bobby Rydell, who blew the audience away with his pipes. This is the rare case of the dropout who deserves his own high school. Bobby Rydell, welcome to Mr.
Thank
Media.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it, Bob. Thank you.
My pleasure, my pleasure. I got to start in an odd place, and I got to talk to you about Greece for a minute, because okay. I was completely – it never registered. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times I have watched that movie. Okay. Rydell High never registered with me. Do you get that from other people?
An awful lot, Bob. You know, why did they name, you know, the high school in Greece Rydell High? I said, I don't have a clue. It could have been Fabian High. It could have been Everly High. It could have been Presley High. It could have been Anka High. They picked Rydell. What an honor, my God, for sure.
How did you first learn of this? When did you first find out? When it went to Broadway, I guess?
You know, unfortunately, I never saw the play, you know, on Broadway. The only play I saw on Broadway was Bye Bye Birdie, which I became a very, very integral part of back when we did the movie back in 1963 with, as you just mentioned, Dick Van Dyke, Janet Leigh, Anne Margaret, myself, Paul Lynn, God rest his soul, Maureen Stapleton, but I saw the Birdie, you know, Broadway show, but I never saw the Grease Broadway show.
But how did you get word that Rydell High was part of the show?
When the movie came out.
Really?
I didn't know that there was going to be Rydell High, you know. And like you said, my dearest friend, I mean, we go back, I was 10 years old. Frankie is a couple of years older than me. And, you know, he became, you know, he got a great part in the movie. It's a wonderful part of the motion picture where he plays Teen Angel, Beauty School Dropouts, yada, yada, yada. And I didn't know anything about, you know, did the kids want to ride Del High? So, you know, when I saw the movie and there it was, you know, with the banners, you know, with the red banner and Rydell and white, you know, white lettering, you know, I said, wow, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
So Frankie got a lot of royalties off of Beauty School Dropout. You get anything off of having a high school named after you?
Not at all.
Sorry.
I didn't even get anything from my own high school, Bishop Newman High School.
Well, so but I imagine you weren't terribly jealous about Frankie getting that song.
Like I said, Bob, we go back. I was 10 years old. And, you know, Frankie was playing trumpet. I sang. I did some impersonations. We used to do USO shows, Veterans Hospital. Frankie had a club here in South Philadelphia called The Frat. was on 17th and Jackson, and I used to go in and play drums and sing and do impersonations. I mean, our friendship goes back so, so far, and to this day, you know, we are the closest of friends. He is my best, best buddy.
So who had their best friend be named Cheech first, yours or Tommy Chong?
Or who?
Tommy Chong.
Oh, well, you know, being Italian, you know, Frank in Italian is Cheech. You know, it's one of those things, you know, like Sinatra. A lot of people call him Frank, you know, the old man, blue eyes, Cheech, you know. So the other guys, you know, the Cheech and Chong, you know. Yeah, I don't know any. I know Cheech, but I don't know Chong.
It was funny in reading the book. There were a couple of times where you only refer to Frankie Avalon as Cheech, and I had to stop him. It stopped me in my tracks a few times. I was like, okay, wait a minute. No, that's what he calls Frankie. I got to keep remembering that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, every time I call Frank, you know, when I call him home in California, when he calls me, he says, "Hey, Ritterelli," you know, which is my, you know, my real name, and I go, "How you doing, Cheech?" You know, and I've always called him Cheech. You know, it's just, it's like a term of endearment. You know, being Italian. You
yeah.
know.
Oh, you're Italian? I didn't know that.
My real name is Ritterelli.
No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. It oozes off of you. I know you're Italian.
Oh, yes.
Besides, I read the book. I know.
Yeah, I got marinara sauce hanging all over.
Is that sauce or is that gravy?
Here in Philadelphia, we call it gravy.
Yeah.
New York, they call it sauce, you know. And we never call it marinara. We call it marinade, you know.
I did not know, even having grown up in New Jersey, I did not realize the difference between gravy and sauce until The Sopranos.
Yeah, it's the same thing. New York calls it sauce. We call it gravy.
New Jersey, know? It's gravy, too. Paulie Walnuts explains that on The Sopranos. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That was new to me. So speaking of which, so you mentioned that you and Cheech go back to, you know, being 10 years old. You started your career so incredibly young. I mean, in Teen Idol on the Rocks, you talk about your dad taking you around to clubs Absolutely. When you were single digits. And the thing I wondered about is, what was the difference between your dad's perception of your talent taking you around to clubs that young and every other proud parent's perception of their kid being talented and, you know, perfect?
I can't answer that question, Bob, to tell you the truth. You know, to go back, you know, when my dad was overseas – war was over, you know, 1945. I was 3 years old. And my mom and my dad, they used to write back to one another, you know, exchange letters. And my mother would say, "The baby's always singing. The baby's always singing." And my father wrote back, "I still have the letter in the house today." And he says, "Who knows? Maybe one day we'll have a star in the family." And the only reason I'm in the business today is because of my dad, God rest his soul.
I know you guys were very close. As I read the early part of the book, I kept thinking, you know, as you talked about your dad taking you around to these places,
right.
I kept expecting at some point you were going to say that you realized, and hear me out on this, that you
sure.
realized that your dad wanted you to be his meal ticket, but that never happened.
No,
I mean, that
no,
was not
no.
it at all.
He wasn't a stage father,
right.
stage mother. He just saw something in me that he was so proud of, Bob. And, you know, when he used to take me around when I was 7, 8 years old, and my mother would say, "What are you doing with the kid?" And my father would say, "Jenny," meaning my mother, "Jenny, the kid's got talent." And my mother would say, "Well, what the hell else are you going to say? You're his father, you know."
Right.
And once again, I mean, God rest his soul, he was my champion, and the reason I'm here today and in the business and as successful as I am is because of my dad.
You've got, I'm trying to remember, 2 kids, 3 kids?
I have 2 children, 5 grandchildren.
And if putting yourself in your father's shoes, if you looked at your 2 kids, who are grown now, I know, and have obviously
right.
have kids of their own, what were their talents? If you were your dad, what would you be spouting about your kids?
I'll tell you, well, they never were really interested in the show business. I mean, my daughter went to a Catholic school called Mary and Mercy. My son went to a private Catholic school, Waldron Academy, you know, not too far from where I live here. And, you know, I remember my daughter, she was about 10, 11 years old at Mary and Mercy, and she had the lead song in Oliver. And, you know, when I went to see her, I cried. Mm. You know, I cried. And she was good. She was really, really good. Robert, at one time, he tried to play trumpet, you know, and it didn't work out. It didn't work out too good. You know, he wasn't a Maynard Ferguson, you know, or, you know, a Harry James. But, I mean, the both kids today, God bless them, are very successful in their. My son works for Mattel, Toys R Us. My daughter works for a food company, and they're both doing great. And they live only 45 minutes from, you know, my home here in Pennsylvania. We go over to Walt Whitman Bridge, both, and I'm there. You know,
they're Jersey kids.
Well, no, they're Philly kids,
but they live in Jersey.
Oh, they live in Jersey now. Yeah, yeah. Most of the guys and girls from the neighborhood, when I grew up in South Philadelphia, everybody moved to Jersey. And my son, when he went to Waldron Academy here, you know, the priests and laymen, the nuns, they would say, "Where are you from?" You know, and my son said, "I'm from South Philly." He thought he was a South Philly guy, but he was born and raised here in the suburbs. You know? But he wanted to be a South Philly guy.
Well, of course, the reason they're all in New Jersey now is once Wawa expanded across the bridge, across the Delaware River into South Jersey, it was safe to move.
I love Wawa.
I knew it. I knew it.
I love Wawa. I love their sandwiches, chicken salad, tuna fish salad. I like their hoagies. I like their soups. They got Italian wedding soup. They got chicken salad soup. Not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing. You're talking to the guy who wrote their book, so I had a feeling if I brought up Wawa, you would be a Wawa guy. So, you know, I mentioned in the intro, and I wasn't sure, you know, you talk about this in the book, but I imagine it's still a little sensitive. You did drop out of high school. Was it a different era to do that in? I mean, was it more acceptable then? If you saw a career ahead of you in high school, whether it was singing or auto repair or whatever it was, right, was it more acceptable to do that then?
You know what, Bob? I really don't know. I wasn't the greatest student in the world. I hated school. I really totally hated school. And when things started happening for me, and that was halfway through my junior year, I left. I left Bishop Newman High School and pursued a career. And when everything started happening for me, there was a priest by the name of Father Pellini. He was a nice guy. He was really a good guy. And he said to me, he said, "Bobby, would you come back to Bishop Newman and do a benefit to raise money for the school? And how much money would you want?" I said, "I'll tell you the truth, Father. I don't want any money. I said, I want my high school ring and I want my diploma." And I got it.
That's great.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. Class of 1960.
Wow. And see, this, I was going to ask you about this. I did a book several years ago with this older gentleman, and he never officially graduated from high school. Became very famous, but he never officially graduated from high school.
Right.
And it bothered him his whole life, and he kept it a secret really into his 80s when I did the book. And then he told me that it was this thing that bothered him. So that's why I wanted to ask. So you got your diploma, you got your ring, you're good.
Yeah, I got my diploma, I got my ring, but the one thing I miss, you know, probably reiterating, you know, what your friend, you know, was talking about, I miss graduating with a class, you know, because Bishop Newman was, you know, an all-boys high school. Mm. It's now co-ed, it's Bishop Newman, St. Maria Goretti. But I miss graduating with, you know, the guys that, you know, I went to school with, hung around the corner with, you know. I miss that particular part of graduation. Yeah, I got my ring, I got my diploma, but that one special thing I missed.
Do you participate in alumni, or do they, you know?
Yeah, every once in a while I'll go back. Yeah, yeah, every once in a while, yeah, I'll go back to Newman.
Nice, yeah. Very nice.
Oh, yeah.
I was just curious. But, of course, you're a high school, and you deserve a diploma, but your high school became really the string of appearances on American Bandstand with Dick Clark. It was bus tours with other teen idols and the Caravan of Stars. But it seems like a lot of that went by in a blur from what I read in the book.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, I'm saying, I'm thinking that, you know, well, when you left Bishop Newman,
right,
it was because your career was taking off. And
correct.
You had the opportunity, instead of sitting in a classroom all the time, your classroom was basically on the road. You were learning the business. You were out on tour.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, it seems like a lot of that went by it's kind of a blur. You'd go to gigs, you'd sleep, you'd wake up, you'd go to the next gig, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way it was. I mean, back then, I think my first tour was either late 59 or 1960. It was the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars. Uh-huh. There were 26 acts on the show, Bob. And I only had two records out at the time. I had Kissin' Time, and I was coming out with my second record, We Got Love. The headliners were Lloyd Price and Paul Anka, you know. But on the bus were people like the Coasters, the Drifters, Dion and the Belmonts, the Skyliners, Freddie Cannon, you know. It was just a wonderful era. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, the music back then, everybody related to, and I think that's why our music has lasted all of these years, because the people refer to that, and I can only think of, you know, the sitcom, you know, Happy Days. And that's what it was back then, man. It was happy. It was really, really happy, you know. I mean, the worst we did as kids was, you know, rob a hubcap, you know, or try to get a dime out of a parking meter, hit it very, very hard, you know.
Right.
I mean, we had no drugs. If you fought, somebody in around the neighborhood, you know, whether you won or you lost the fight, when the fight was over, you shook hands. You became the best of friends. Mm. That don't happen anymore,
yeah, man.
Too many guns and knives and dope and a lot of crap.
Well, now, on those bus tours, as you mentioned the Coasters, and it was a very, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a very integrated tour, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. But you know what, Bob? There's something about show business, man, where a racial issue never comes into play. You just respected one another's talent. You respected them as human beings, as persons. It wasn't black, it wasn't white, it wasn't green, it wasn't purple. You know, you just had a great time together. And once again, reiterating, they were the best days of my life.
Did being on tour, you mentioned Bo Diddley in the book.
Right.
I got to spend an hour with back in the mid-80s. It was real highlight, just sitting opposite with him, and, you know, just a fascinating guy. But, you know, coming from South Philly, race is, you know, has been an issue in Philly. And what did being on tour with white artists, black artists?
Maybe today, Bob, but not back then.
No, huh?
Race was never a big issue. Never a big issue.
Even on tour, going to maybe some cities where, you know, it was different. What I was getting at is.
Well, you know, I remember, I think on one tour was Joey D and the Starlighters. And I believe at that time, you know, this is going back quite a while, but I believe his drummer was black. And we were somewhere in the Deep South, you know, Alabama, you know, Tennessee, whatever. And I came walking out of the hotel with my arm around the drummer, Joey D's drummer, who was black. And he said, he got my arm and he took my arm and put it down by my side. And he said, "Hey, man, don't you know where you're at?" And I never, never even had one thought about the racial issue deep down in the South. He was a friend, man. We were musicians. We were in the business together. Our camaraderie was absolutely fantastic. You know, it's really unfortunate, you know, today, the way things are happening. And once again, man, you know, it's over. Mm-hmm. That part of it is over. There was nothing better than growing up in the 50s and the early 60s. It's a marvelous time.
All right. I was just curious because, I mean, I've read, you know, I remember reading, I've read Chuck Berry's memoir, and I think I read Little Richard, I think his memoir, talking to Bo Diddley years ago, and I know that they had some real issues with touring in the South. And
well, they probably did, yeah.
I just wondered, you know, but the caravan.
You know, unfortunately, I they were a little bit, you know, in front of me. Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and Little Richard, you know. My era was the Drifters, the Coasters, you know, so on and so forth, you know, Bo Diddley, you know. So it was, you know, totally different back then.
Sticking with 63 for a minute, you talk in the book about getting the role of Hugo opposite Anne Margaret as Kim in Bye Bye Birdie. I'd love to hear more about working on the film. You mentioned, of course, Dick Van Dyke was on the film, Janet Leigh. The one anecdote that really made me laugh in the book was you talked about Janet Leigh's reaction to how Anne Margaret was photographed or filmed.
Oh, my God, yeah. I wasn't there. They had the premiere of Bye Bye Birdie somewhere in Sunset Boulevard, California. And George Sidney, who was the director of Bye Bye Birdie, was in love with Anne Margaret. So all you saw was 35 millimeter Panavision shots, you know, of her face, her behind, you know, her breasts, you know. And Janet Leigh ran out of that theater. That son of a... and she was talking about George Sidney. But... you know, I never saw that. You know, I wasn't there. Working on the film with all those people were wonderful. They were all great. Dick Van Dyke, Janet Leigh, of course, Anne Margaret, Paul Lynn, God rest his soul, Maureen Stapleton. You know, was a great cast, and we all got along very, very well together.
Any, you know, Dick Van Dyke is still with us, 91, yeah. 92. He's still singing and dancing. I wondered if you had any stories from working with him, any experiences you could share.
He was just really a super dynamite to work with. He was easy to work with, you know, him being the older guy, me a young kid. I was 21, Ann was 22 when we made that movie back in 63. But, you know, if there were things that, you know, I did wrong, you know, Dick would come over and he would say, Bobby, you know, if you can do it this way and if you make a little bit move here, you know, it'll be better for me to, you know, yada, 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 so on and so forth. And, you know, what can you do but learn from these people? You know, people like a Maureen Stapleton who's done God knows how many movies. And that's the great thing about my career. I was really happy that it was my phone or something.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, no, that's my wife. My wife's ringtone is Volare. So, you want to get that phone, huh?
That was great.
And my ringtone is Dean Martin.
Oh, really? What song?
Yeah, Dean Martin. Ain't That a Kick in the Head? That's my ringtone.
That is.
But anyway, you know, once again, reiterating, you know, being, you know, I was so very, very young in the business. My first appearance in Vegas was George Burns at the Sahara Hotel, working with Jack Benny, Red Skelton, Danny Thomas, Perry Como. And you could do nothing but learn from these people. I used to stand in the wings when I was done with George Burns and just watch him. I would just watch him, how he delivered a line, what his timing was, you know. It's absolutely fantastic. What a great way to grow up, you know, to be with these stalkers, you know, the real stalkers of the business, you know. It's great.
Anything you can tell me about being around Jack Benny? I love that guy. I'm just a huge...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I actually listened to the entire run of the Jack Benny radio show a few years ago.
Wow.
So I just, when I saw that, you know, I saw you had been on his show a couple of times, I think. I'm just curious if, you know, any Jack Benny stories.
Well, you know, how old was I at that time when I did Benny? I guess maybe 19, 20, something like that. And, you know, other than my hits, I did some, you know, I did a couple of songs like from the American Songbook. And then, you know, after I'm done that, Mr. Benny called me out, and now we have a little bit of dialogue together, you know, and I tell him that I have to give him some kind of constructive criticism, you know, and I do a take like Benny would do, you know, well, you know, and then, you know, he fell in love with me, and he took me on the road with him. We did 2 weeks. We did in Los Angeles, we did a theater in the round, and then in Phoenix, Arizona, a theater in the round. So, you know, I was, once again, so fortunate to be able to work with, you know, these guys. My God, you know, absolutely tremendous. People that I adored, you know, as a kid, as you said, listening to radio shows.
Right.
You know.
Now, touring a couple weeks with Benny, that he would choose you to go out with him, that knowing everyone that he knew, which was pretty much everyone in the business, for him to say, hey, I want Bobby Rydell out on the road with me for a couple weeks, that's a pretty big deal.
Oh, and you know, what an honor.
Yeah.
My God, what an honor to be, you know, not only do his TV show, but to be able to travel with him for a couple of weeks and being, you know, like the second banana, you know, on the show. Yeah.
I've read too that he had for a guy who was so family friendly on the air, that he could be a little more risque, a little darker off stage. Did you get any sense of that?
Well, the only thing that I know, you know, him and George Burns, they were, you know, so tight. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were the best of friends. And I remember George Burns telling me a story where Benny was working Vegas, and George Burns comes out through the wings, balls ass naked, and Benny just fell apart. Yeah, and you know that's how close their friendship was. You know, like George Burns could say hello to Jack Benny, and Jack Benny would lose it.
Right.
You know, he'd just fall down laughing. Yeah.
All right. I was just curious. Thank you for indulging me.
No, it's all.
So let's talk a little bit about a couple of your songs. We've gone a long way around to come to this point. Tell me, first time you got your hands on Volare, and you know when
Volare. I went to you know, I was with Cameo Records at the time. We went to New York City, RCA Recording Studios, to do an album, and we never released the album. But the songs that I recorded on the album were Volare, Sway, and Old Black Magic, which became hits for me. Mm-hmm. Now, I was coming off a song called Swingin' School, and we needed a record, you know, coming off of Swingin' School. Bernie Lowe, the president of Cameo, went back and listened to the tapes that we did in New York City, and he listened to Volare, and then he said, well, let's put the three grandmothers on there to do the whoa, whoa, yeah, yeah, la, 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 la. So on and so forth, and we released it, became my second million seller.
And would it surprise you if I told you that when I looked on iTunes today, that Forget Him actually rates slightly higher in popularity than Volare?
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. Well, yeah, you know, if you go to a wedding or some kind of a bar mitzvah or whatever it may be, if in fact they do Volare, it's my version. Mm. So everybody sings, whoa, 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 yay, la, 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 you know, stuff like that. You know, they don't do Domenico Modugno's version, they don't do Dee Martin's version, they do Bobby Rydell's version. But Forget Him, that was recorded in London, England, and it was written by a guy, Tony Hatch, who wrote songs like Downtown for Petula Clark, Call Me for Chris Montez, you know, really nice bossa nova. And when I'm on stage and I do my show live, you know, and basically we have a little vamp and I say good evening, so on and so forth, and I just get into a little story, and I talk about Tony Hatch, and I say, I'd like to do that song that Mr. Hatch wrote for you, and I say, thank you ever so much for the third million seller. Had a nice lyric, a good melody. Song's entitled Forget Him, and you hear the audience, oh. So you're right. You're right.
Yeah, yeah, I was surprised. I expected to see, you know, I don't know if you look at iTunes much, but it lists the songs by each artist according to popularity on iTunes. And Forget Him is above Volare, and I was just wow.
Yeah. I would think so, yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. And the other one I want to ask you about was Wild One, of course.
Yeah. Wild One, let me see. We were going to New York City, Dave Apple. We were in a limo from Philadelphia to New York City to do Dick Clark's Saturday Night Beach Nut Spearman Gum Show, right? So, let me see. The second tune was a song called We Got Love. Now, in the limo, Dave always had a pipe in his mouth, and he always carried his guitar with him. And he said, Bobby, when we get back, he said, this is going to be the next song we record. You know, and he started with his guitar, with the pipe in his mouth. And we went back to Philadelphia at a place called Recco Art. It was on 12th and Vine Street, and we recorded, you know, with the girls that were, you know, of course, you know, they were my sound. Whoa, whoa, yeah, yeah, you know. And we recorded Wild One, and we put it, and on the B-side of Wild One, you know, I had a double-sided hit on that. The B-side was a song called Little Bitty Girl. And everybody thought that Little Bitty Girl was going to be the A-side, and some disc jockey somewhere turned the record over and started playing Wild One. Pow! And it went through the ceiling. Yeah.
Oh, and it's a song, even today, everybody knows that song.
I hope so.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. All right, so tell me about writing your memoir. I mean, how you had a lot of years to cover. I mean, you know, starting as young as you did and continuing to work today, you've rarely not been working steadily. How do you do that? How do you sit down and collect it all?
Well, the whole crux of the situation was, you know, being on the road for, you know, close to 60 years, you know, and after doing a show, you sit with some people, you sit down, you talk, you know, and you know, it's kind of relate stories. And 99% of the people, you know, say to me, Bobby, you have such great stories. Why don't you write a book? I'm talking about a lot of years ago, Bob. And I would go, yeah, a book, yeah, come on, you know, forget about it. And the girl I'm married to now, we're married 7 years, Linda Hoffman. My first wife passed away in 2003 via breast cancer, Camille. And she said to me, Bobby, why don't you sit down? Why don't you sit down and put something together? So I got together with Alan Slutsky, who's the co-writer of the book. And Alan, he's won Grammys. He won the Ralph... F. Gleason Award on Rolling Stone magazine for the best book of the year, and that was In the Shadows of Motown. So I said, well, I got to get together with Alan. He's a fine musician. He's already written books. So I think he knows, you know, where we have to go. And we sat down for 18 months. He had a tape recorder. He had a sheet of paper in front of him writing down notes, and we just started. I'm sorry.
What was the easy part of doing the book? The stories or whatever part?
Oh, my God. I mean, the easy part was, you know, once again, working with the champions, Red Skelton, George Burns, Jack Benny, Perry Como, Danny Thomas, you know, meeting Sinatra, you know, for the first time, being 19 years old. You know, all of that stuff was good stuff. And the hard part was, you know, talking about my family and the way my mother was, you know, and everybody, you know, thought my mother was, you know, one of the greatest people to ever walk the face of the earth. My mom, you know, back then, you know, there was no medicine for, like today, bipolar. Uh-huh. And my mother was. My mother, and it was hard. It was really, really hard. But, you know, I think of myself, and I think a lot of fans know that, you know, I'm a sincere guy. I'm an honest guy. A very, very truthful guy, and I said, you know, this is going to be tough, but I got to talk about my mom and what the people didn't see, you know, behind the scenes. It was tough, but I had to get it out there, Bob. You know,
you when she, you know, you reach a point in the book where you say where she passed, and it was after Camille passed, you lost your mom. It was you lost your dad, you lost Camille, you lost your mom. And after she passed, it was I was amazed but not surprised that you said it was like 200 pounds was taken off of you. And it was a very raw and honest moment when you admit that.
Well, that's what I tried to be in the book, Bob, and it really was. It was like a weight, you know, taken off my shoulder since I was 3 years old. You know, I can't say that I didn't love her. As far as a mother and a son relationship, she had her moments. She had her good moments, but very far, few, and in between.
There's a nice picture of you about a year before she passed, and you and your mom in Atlantic City. And I thought, that's nice that you share that picture, because people can say, okay, well, she did have at least a moment with her son where, you know, they looked they looked like everything was good.
Oh, she was, you know what, Bob? She was very, you know, after, you know, my dad did all of this stuff, and what are you doing with your son, and yada, yada, yada. She was a very, very proud person. But, you know, she kind of wanted to rule, you know, my career. You know, she wasn't a stage mother, but in the background, she was kind of like a stage mother. Where my father, you know, he wasn't a stage father. You know, he was just so proud of me. You know, he was really, really proud. And it got to the point where I could never, never, ever please my mother. No matter what I did on stage, there was always something that I could have done better in her mind, you know. And I'm going, Mom, you know, my God, you know, I'm doing my hits. I'm doing American Songbook. I'm singing songs that none of the acts of today are doing. You know, I'm doing tunes like, I'm doing three tunes from Sinatra's Only the Lonely album. I'm doing What's New, Angel Eyes, you know. Make it one for my baby. What do you want, Mom?
Right.
You
know? Right. And she probably couldn't have told you if she did, even if she knew.
Yeah.
You, so the flip side of your mom is that you have had, a lot of these books, you know, written by someone of your era, a man of your era who's been through what you did, a lot of these would be a stream of stories about women in and out of the doors and backstage and everything. You write about two women in this book, Camille, your first wife, Linda,
right.
Your second wife. It comes across as a very enviable situation. Camille was willing to take a back seat for a long time.
Absolutely.
Pretending that you weren't even married, that you weren't even dating for years.
That's right, because, I mean, even before we got married, if she used to come to a concert or something, she would be introduced as my cousin. Not my girlfriend, not my future wife. It was tough. You know, it was tough on her. But we had, you know, we had 36 years of a phenomenal marriage. She was a wonderful, wonderful lady. When I lost her back in 2003, I fell apart. And that's what led to the drinking and the cirrhosis and the transplant. And like the book says, you know, Teen Idol on the Rocks, a tale of second chances. And basically, that's where I'm at right now.
And you got fortunate a second time. Now, I'm guessing that's Linda who I saw behind you a minute ago.
Yeah.
So maybe you don't want to say anything nice about her in front of her. But
No. She's a rotten person.
There we go.
Hey, listen, Bob. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be around today. She was the greatest caretaker, and she was a nurse for 36 years. And, you know, prior to my transplant surgery, you know, in 2010 – I got the transplant in 2012. I became very, very, very sick. I mean, ascites and encephalopathy and, you know, losing weight. I was a skeleton. I was like 116 pounds from 180, you know. And she would always say, oh, you're going to be fine, you know. But she knew. Yeah, I mean, she knew if I didn't get a liver, you know, I was, as we say in Italian, morto, you're dead, you know. And I was very, very lucky. Here's my Bella barking at some beers outside. And what can I say about my old lady now, Linda? She's
he married me for health care.
Yeah, right. I got a live-in. Got a live-in nurse, you know. So.
Some people have Obamacare, you have Linda
care. She gives me aspirin, she gives me shots. Sometimes I don't know what the hell she's giving me, tell you the truth.
I think she just gave you a shot a minute ago.
Yeah, right, she did.
South Philly shot. Now, and I want to ask just one other thing about the drinking. What kind of start to wind it down, but
yeah.
I mean, there are occasional references earlier in the book to you know, you would have a drink, you'd be with Sinatra. You talked about nursing a Coke the first time you met Sinatra.
Oh well, so, I was 19 at that time,
right?
You know, I really wasn't, you know, I didn't drink. And when Mr. Sinatra, when I'm sitting with him at the Copacabana, he said, "What do you drink, Robert?" I said, "Coke." I figured if I said scotch and water, I'd get smacked in the face, you know. But to go back, you know, when Camille passed away, that part of my life just, you know, it, like everything went into the toilet. You know, I was a basket case. And all of a sudden, Vatya became my very, very dear friend. I mean, I when Camille and I were married, you know, we go out to dinner. I was a social drinker. I have, you know, a martini or something before dinner, maybe a liqueur after dinner, and that was it, you know. And I never drank in between, but when she passed away, I became an alcoholic. I became a drunk. And to the point, it's in the book, hiding bottles in my golf bag, in the trunk of my car. God forbid half of the bottle was going in the refrigerator, I'd have to make a beeline to the liquor store because, God forbid, I ran out of vodka, you know, which led to cirrhosis of the liver, you know, and, God, you know, just lucky to be here.
And now, one other thing I want to ask you about, and we'll just kind of wrap up, but people will see this because this is a video interview. You have been, you know, smoking during the course of the interview.
I've been smoking since 10 years old.
And have you, you know, I'm surprised in this day and age. A lot of people have quit. The guy who sings, have you kept smoking at all because that is your voice, or is it just habit you can't break?
You know, going back to Frankie Avalon, you know, and once again, we've known one another for God knows how many years. And he said to me, "Bobby, when are you going to stop smoking?" And I'd look at him, I'd say, "Frank, I don't know, Cheech, you know." And then he turned to me and he said, "You know what? Don't stop. It'll probably screw up your voice if you stop smoking." <You know? laughs> So I'm not proud of it, Bob, by no stretch of the imagination. But, I what was? The easiest thing to do was stop drinking. But to stop smoking? God in heaven. But the amazing part about it is, like, you know, I've been to Australia 23 times in my life, since 1960 up to last year. Well, yeah, 2015. And, you know, you get a flight from Philly to L.A. or San Francisco, and then once you're in the airport, I mean, that's it. There's no smoking. Then you get on a flight from, you know, the West Coast to direct to Sydney, 15 hours, 40 minutes, no smoking. And I can handle it. I have no problem. As soon as when that plane lands in Sydney, I can't wait to get outside. I put like a carton in my mouth. How stupid am I?
Well, I didn't ask the question to be judgmental. I was mostly just surprised.
Go ahead.
No, I was just surprised with your voice, and you have such an incredible voice.
Thank you.
I was surprised to see the cigarettes come out. That's all.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so last question, and as someone who's gone through the alcoholism and cirrhosis and the transplants, you probably, I'm guessing, may have given some thought to what your legacy will be, should be, what you'd like, how you'd like to be remembered.
Are you talking about something that I don't know about?
Oh, no. I'm just, no, I mean,
I'm only kidding.
I'd like to come back and talk to you in another 20, 30 years, but I'm just saying.
I don't know if I'll be around that.
Well, I'm just saying, you know.
I got a new lease on life. Hopefully I'll be around for another 10, possibly 15. You know, my dad was 89 when he passed away. I'll be 74. So maybe I got another, you know, 15 years. I don't know.
Your mom was
legacy,
91.
Legacy, right? Wow. God, you know, I just hope people remember me for being the kind of guy that I am, being very sincere, very honest, very, very true to my word. And, you know, possibly like the guy next door that you can knock upon his door and talk to him at any time you want. And that's the way I would want to be remembered. You know, through my career, you know, I always had time for my fans. I don't care how many pictures they want to take. I don't care how many autographs they want to be signed. I'd like to be remembered as a nice guy. Period.
Well, folks, you can find Nice Guy Bobby Rydell's autobiography, Teen Idol, On the Rocks, A Tale of Second Chances, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it, and any of his albums, right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching this if you're watching the video on MrMedia.com, below the video to the left or the right, you will see a copy of the book. You can click on it right now and get it delivered within a day or two, most likely. So do that. Bobby, do you have a website? Do you have are you on social media?
The book, the release date is May the 4th. Okay, so we already have a lot of pre-orders, and they can go to BobbyRydellBook.com, and you can order it in three different ways. You can order it just the book, or you want it autographed, or do you want a special, you know, a special message, you know, like to, you know, whoever, you know, thanks, you know, for being such a great fan. Love always, Bobby Rydell. And that's BobbyRydellBook.com. And as of May the 4th, it'll be on Amazon, you know, Barnes & Noble. But they can still go to the website as well.
Hmm. That'd be nice. So get your book and get it autographed. You can't do better than that, folks. Bobby Rydell, just a fascinating time talking to you, a fascinating life. And thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of men of a certain age who wish they had spent months of their formative years dancing with Anne Margaret in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.